Okay, let us begin. In the, you know, every week we read a section from the Torah, and we read a section from the prophets. And presumably the section from the prophets somehow is connected with the section of the Torah. I mean, more so, not just connected. Presumably it focuses, elucidates, explains, gives insight to a part of the portion. So in this week in the Haftorah, which in that book I think you can find on page 1141. It's a prophecy which comes from the first chapter of a prophet called Ovadia. And it starts off a vision of Ovadia, so said my Lord God, Hashem, about Edom. So who's Edom? Edom is another name for Esav. Edom means red. Esav, when he was born, came out all red. There's a later episode where also he asks about the red food, the red porridge. It's not real positive. I mean, if you're rooting for Edom, it's not real positive. It's your bar mitzvah parsha.
What?
It's your bar mitzvah parsha.
No,
Vayesha. Uh-huh. Towards the end, it says as follows. Verse 18, page 1142. V'haya beit Yaakov esh, uveit Yosef lehava, uveit Esav lekash, v'dalku behem v'achalum. And the house of Jacob will be like a fire, the house of Jacob will be a fire. That like was unnecessary. See, I spent 4 days in California last week, and now... And now like somehow entered into my vocabulary. The house of Jacob will be a fire, and the house of Joseph a flame, and the house of Esav like straw. They will kindle among them and consume them, and there will be no survivor of the house of Esav. As I said, not real positive. At the very end, there's a more familiar verse. Then saviors will ascend Mount Zion to judge Esav's mountain, and the kingdom will be God's, will be Hashem's. Which means clearly this description is a description of the end of days. So we perhaps need to fill in a little piece of missing information. In Judaism, very, very clearly, and this is something which is articulated in two different places in this week's portion, that Jacob is synonymous with Israel. Jacob's other name becomes Yisrael, Israel. So when we see Jacob in a later prophecy, like a book like this, Jacob no longer means exclusively the biblical character who lived 4,000 years ago, rather talks about the Jewish people. When we see Esav, 4,000 years into history, or from this point, Esav no longer means an individual who was a biblical character, but also it becomes an identity for a nation. Now, if one consults Jewish writings, certainly from the Second Temple time, one would see that Esav is associated with Rome. If one looks at later writings, one will see that Esav becomes associated with Christianity. So this prophecy is saying the day will come that Esav will no longer exist, but what exactly will be the impetus in terms of the destruction? And I want to be very clear about this. Esav begins as a nice Jewish boy, raised in a nice Jewish home, who's a twin brother to Jacob. He makes choices in terms of his identity, and he ends up rejecting the upbringing of his parents, and he takes upon a new identity. If we look at the vast majority of the history between the Jews and the Christians, it's not been a terribly wonderful one or uplifting one. Which means the Jewish experience, and by the way, that's one of the ironies of today. When I say today, I mean the the points of history that we're at. For the most part, Judaism was able to reconcile itself within an Islamic life or worldview, and there was not a tension at the very essence of the being of the two different belief systems. It doesn't mean that Jews were going to convert, it doesn't mean that Muslims were going to convert, but they were able to live together, to coexist. On the other hand, the Jewish existence within the Christian world was seen as something which just brought the anger out, and we were accused of all kinds of things. Perhaps the most obscene accusation in the history of the world is that we were accused of deicide, killing a god, which sounds pretty much like a contradiction in terms to me. But who am I to argue with 2,000 years of Christian history and theology, which found the Jews guilty for everything, and there was no particular punishment which was deemed to be insufficient. So just like Esav transforms himself from being being a believer of God and having a lack of hostility, there seems to be a point in time where Esav will cease to exist in his identity of being the person who hates Jacob, and therefore there is a possibility for a new existence to take place. So over here, when it talks about Esav disappearing, I don't think it necessarily means that Esav must be obliterated. There's a lot more to talk about this, but let that suffice. But I want to focus a bit more on the process. What did it say here? It says, the house of Jacob will be a fire, the house of Joseph a flame. The Hebrew is Beit Yaakov Esh, Beit Yosef Lehava. The idea of Lehava sounds like it's the spark. See, it was appropriate that you were playing with the lighter before we started. I don't know if you realized that was the theme of the Haftarah. Divine inspiration is all over. But it sounds like Jacob will burn, but Joseph will light the flame. He'll be the spark that lights the flame. And then the house of Esav will go up like straw. So why exactly is Joseph singled out to be the one, or the impetus, the catalyst for Esav's destruction? That's really what I want to focus on. So the Talmud notices an interesting turn of phrase, which was in last week's portion. Last week in chapter 30, verse 23, it says that Rachel became pregnant, Rachel gave birth, Rachel had a son, and she named his son Yosef. And she said, hopefully God will give me another son. V'tikrat shmo Yosef, lemor Yosef Hashem li ben acher. Hopefully God will give me another son. Then it continues and says as follows. Vayihi kasher yoldar Rachel et Yosef, when Rachel gave birth to Yosef. Vayomer Yaakov el Lavan, in mid-sentence, when Rachel gave birth, Yaakov said to Lavan, Shalcheni, let me go. Ve'elcha mekomi ulartzi, I want to return back to my place and back to my land. So here's the question. What exactly is the correlation or the connection between the birth of Yosef and Yaakov coming back to land? Now let's focus on this week's portion. In this week's portion, when Yaakov does come back, he's afraid. He's afraid of confrontation. He's afraid of facing Esav, because Esav said something very simple to him. As soon as our father is dead, I'm going to kill you. Yaakov ran away for a long time. Now Yaakov's coming back and he's scared. He's scared coming back into the land of Israel. Now, if he is scared, if he is afraid, then why come back? Moreover, why come back just because Yosef is born? What's that connection? What was the logical flow when it says, and Yosef was born, and Yaakov says, okay, it's time to go back? The Talmud says as follows. This is in Baba Batra on page 123b. what happened with the birth of Yosef? Ra'ah Yaakov, Yaakov saw, Ra'ah Yaakov Avinu, She'ein Zar'o Shel Esav, Nimsiru Elo B'yad Zar'o Shel Yosef, that the descendants of Esav will one day fall in the hands of the descendants of Yosef. And now I want to stop a second and explain this. Because the Talmud is very clearly not talking about the past. When I say the past, the Talmud is not discussing the biblical Esav and the biblical Joseph. Why do I say that? Pay attention to the terminology. What inspired Yaakov to come back? It was the knowledge that one day the descendants of Esav would fall at the hands of the descendants of Yosef, which means the Talmud is talking about further on down the line. Why? The Talmud, when it has to prove this point, it goes back to this particular verse. Now, I want to pause here for a second. We don't know why Yosef would have dominion over Esav. We don't know what the flow of logic is in the passage. But there's another source that says almost the same thing, but it phrases it somewhat different. It said that because it was known to Jacob that Esav would only fall to a son of Rachel. Now, what's the difference between saying a son of Rachel versus saying Joseph exclusively? So remember, when Yosef is born, what does Rachel say? God, give me another son. Eventually, she does have another son. The other son's name is Benjamin, Binyamin. So if I say, formulate this the way the Talmud does, then the only son, the only lineage or genealogy which is significant is that of Yosef. But if I say that it's any son of Rachel, that includes Binyamin. So I want to pause here and just show you the fork in the road that we're at, because there really are two directions. First of all, one of the more obscure teachings of Jewish eschatology, eschatology meaning the vision of the end of days, the messianic times, it's very well known, the idea of the Messiah. Right? I think it's very hard to have been brought up in a Judeo-Christian society without ever hearing the word Messiah. In Judaism, there are actually two Messiahs. One Messiah is the famous one, known as the Messiah, the son of David. The other Messiah, who's not as well known, is known as Messiah, the son of Joseph. To the best of my knowledge, he's only mentioned one place in the Talmud. That's a passage in Sukkah on page 52. And even there, there's a difference of opinion about a scene that will take place. Will there be a great deal of crying, what the crying, where it came from, if it comes from a whole separate theological issue, or it comes because the Messiah, the son of Joseph, will be killed. So the only thing that the Talmud says about the Messiah, the son of Joseph, is that he may be killed. Or when he's killed, there'll be a lot of crying. Nonetheless, if I take a thinker as important as the Vilna Gaon, who in his lifetime was probably the most important religious leader or thinker in the world, the Vilna Gaon died 200 years ago. His entire mystical eschatological philosophy, which turned into a very practical philosophy, was based upon this concept called the Messiah, the son of Joseph. A matter of fact, it was the Vilna Gaon who sent his students to Israel 200 years ago to start to rebuild Jerusalem because of his messianic calculations and understanding of the role of Messiah, the son of Joseph. And even though the Talmud says that Messiah, the son of Joseph, will be killed, it's been the position of the leading Kabbalists of the last 500 years that even though it says that he dies, he doesn't have to die, which means man could prevent him from dying. And even though you may think he's dead, it doesn't mean that he's dead, which I know is terribly confusing. But just if I go back to the biblical Joseph, I'm not talking about Messiah, the son of David. If I go back to the biblical Joseph, Joseph is the son of Jacob. For how many years did Jacob think that Joseph was dead? 22 years. He thought he was dead, but he was really in Egypt. And therefore, there's this concept, Od Yosef Chai, Yosef is really still alive. So even though the Messiah, the son of Joseph, there are rumors that he may have died, man could keep the son of Joseph alive. And just to make all this much more complicated, according to, again, Kabbalists going back for 400 years now, there is a Messiah, the son of Joseph, in every generation. What exactly that role is, that's not for today. But I'll just start it by saying the Messiah, the son of Joseph, is the one who starts to rebuild Jerusalem, the one who starts to build Israel. According to the book called the Megala Amukos, absolutely both. Here, let's think for a second. When the Jews are in the desert, and the first battle comes up, remember what that battle is? It's the battle against Amalek. Moses is there as a leader. Who does Moses send down to fight against Amalek? He sends Joshua. Why Joshua? Joshua is the descendant of Joseph. Which means when over here we're told that the descendants of Esav, Amalek is indeed a descendant of Esav, will fall at the hands of a descendant of Joseph, so therefore Joshua is sent. Joshua, by the way, is the prototype for the Messiah, the son of Joseph. Because what's the role of Joshua? He's the one who leads the Jews into the land, he captures the land, divides the land, and then David comes in, and together with his son they build the temple. Which means the role of the Messiah, the son of Joseph, is to take care of all the physical needs. By the way, as Yisrael Salanter once said, for me to take care of your physical needs is a spiritual gesture. For me to take care of my own physical needs is a physical gesture. Which means don't think of the Messiah, the son of Joseph, as somebody who has no spirituality about him, quite the opposite. Joshua is quite a spiritual leader. But by the way, who was the first one who takes care of all the brothers? It's Joseph himself. Joseph becomes a king. Joseph becomes a leader. Joseph then takes care of all of his brothers. That's the prototype of the Messiah, the son of Joseph. Joshua follows along the line. By the way, if I pause a second, there is also a whole line which comes through Benjamin. So I want to pause a second and think about Benjamin. As I told you, there is a source that Esav will only fall in the hands of a son of Rachel. And there are those who understand that this deals with Benjamin as well. What supports the candidacy of Benjamin? So let's stop and consider something. There's a source I'm going to quote, which is from 800 years ago. It's called Tosfot. Tosfot writes in his commentary to the Torah as follows. He wants to know the following point. Why the temple will one day stand in the portion of Benjamin? And he gives a couple of different interpretations. His first interpretation is, or explanation, is that Benjamin from all the sons of Joseph Benjamin, from all the sons of Jacob, was the only one who was born in the land of Israel. And because he's born in the land of Israel, he there possesses a higher level of spirituality, and therefore the temple will be built in his portion. That's one explanation. The second interpretation is, and that goes right down to this week's portion, do you remember when Jacob and Esav meet? Jacob and all of his sons line up, and they all bow down. All the sons bow down except for one son. Which one is that? Why? Because he wasn't born yet. Trick question. But listen to what it says. Fast forward to another episode in the Bible. He writes as follows. V'yesh mefurishim, some commentary say, she'adayin lo noldu, kishistachavu l'shvatim la'esav, Benjamin wasn't born yet. And v'hu dichtiv, and that's why it says later on, u'mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. Now, listen. Do you remember in the story of Purim, there's a man named Haman? Haman is descendant of Esav, he's descendant of Amalek. Haman tries to get everyone to bow down to him. One person doesn't bow down, and that's Mordechai. Now, who is Mordechai? What tribe does he come from? Mordechai comes from the tribe of Benjamin. Ish Yehudi, Hayah B'Shushan Abira, Ushmo Mordechai, Ben Kish, Ish Yemini. Ish Yemini means a man of Benjamin. Ish Yemini, a Benjamite. So it says all the Jews bow down, but by Mordechai it says, any of you guys know Hebrew? Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. Now the problem with that sentence is it didn't say it in the past tense. Mordechai lo kara v'lo yishtachaveh. It says it in the future. Mordechai lo yichra. Mordechai will never bow down v'lo yishtachaveh and will not prostrate himself. Now that's very strange. So over here, Tosfot says that he heard that there's an explanation that all the other brothers, or all the other Jews, will bow down. Why? Because they're from all the other tribes. But somebody at the time of Benjamin doesn't have to bow down. And I want you to appreciate what this is telling us. And this maybe is really the lesson that we need to get out of today's class. If something happened in the Bible 4,000 years ago, it creates an echo which can still be heard today. The behavior of the biblical characters creates spiritual realities, sometimes in an incredibly positive way and sometimes in a negative way. So therefore, the fact that everyone bows down to Esav creates subservience. It means that throughout history, Jews are unfortunately going to be subservient to Esav, to Rome, to Christianity, because the brothers bow down. But there will be a sliver of Jews who won't, and that's Mordechai. That's the Mordechai of every generation. Mordechai lo yichra v'lo yishtachaveh. Mordechai will not bow down. Why? Because Mordechai comes from Binyamin. So it's interesting, because according to this, the temple will be built in that section, the whole of Binyamin. The holiness of Binyamin is such that he is never subservient, and therefore Binyamin will never have to bow down. And by the way, the deeper point over here may be related to something else in this week's portion. You can't help but notice the irony. There's two different sections in the very beginning. First, we have Yaakov preparing for battle. Then night falls, and Yaakov has a confrontation with an unknown assailant. According to Jewish tradition, this unknown assailant is none other than Esav's heavenly or spiritual guide. And they wrestle, and he hurts Yaakov's thigh. Day breaks, Yaakov gets up, faces Esav, and he bows down to him and so on, but he's able to avoid battle. Now, you would read this and say, wow, that's really strange. When it comes to the heavenly protector of Esav, then he wrestles and he gets hurt. When it comes to Esav, nothing happens. So it's not true that nothing happened. Something did happen. What happened? He bowed down. Some of the Kabbalistic commentaries point out that when you bow down, you use your legs to stretch out and to bow down. Yaakov's leg being hurt is directly connected to his bowing down, and that caused spiritual pain, and therefore Jews in the future will be subservient, except for Binyamin. So therefore, what we're able to discern is that we have a tradition that Esav will either fall to a son of Rachel, and now we understand the Binyamin part, or Esav will fall to a son, to a specific son of Rachel, and that's Joseph. So why would Joseph have any kind of superiority in terms of Esav? That's something which we still don't understand exactly where that's coming from. So I want you to think for a moment. What do we know about Esav? One thing that we know is that he honored his father. When the rabbis tell us that he honored his father, it said, Tzayid bepiv, there was hunting in his mouth. It says that he honors his father by asking him questions. One of the questions they asked him was, if you have straw, do you need to give a tenth to tzedakah, to charity? That's very interesting, because you know in Jewish tradition later on, we will give on a Torah level for certain species, on a rabbinic level to other species, but straw is not something you have to give miser from or give a tenth of. And when Esav is asking such a question, Yitzchak apparently is fooled into thinking that Esav is some kind of a spiritual individual. So let's keep that in mind and continue. When I compare or contrast Esav and Yosef, maybe I'll read a couple of commentaries that grapple with this problem. One says as follows. This is a book called the Todos Yitzchak. V'yesh l'shol, and one can ask, Lama Yosef sitno shel Esav yoter mishar ha'achim? Why was Yosef more of an enemy or an antidote to Esav more than the other brothers? And he says, Atshuva sheYosef yavom Esav l'din, that one day they will come to trial. And he'll ask him, Lama asit rad l'achich Yaakov? Yosef will ask Esav, why did you treat your brother so poorly? What will he say to him? He'll say, look what Yaakov did to me. Right? Yaakov stole the birthright from me. Yaakov took the blessings from me. And what will Yosef answer? And did your brothers try to kill you the way that my brothers try to kill me? And did I take revenge on them? Or did I end up turning around and taking care of them? Which means if Esav has complaints about the way that his brother treated him, Yosef will be able to have moral superiority to Esav and to say, you were not mistreated more than I was mistreated, and I did not take vengeance the way that you tried. I didn't go around killing anybody. I mean, obviously we need to understand Yosef's whole approach. I think, in fact, the opposite is true. I think what Yosef tries to do throughout the episode when he deals with his brothers is he tries to get them to say that he's sorry. He tries to get them to do tshuva, to repent. But he certainly was in the position to kill all of them if he wanted to. And no one would have, right? He could have lined up his brothers and killed them as the leading political figure in Egypt, and no one would have been able to do anything about it. And Yosef doesn't do that. Second approach is found in the Kli Yakar. He says, look, Reuven made an error in judgment. In this week's portion, we're told that Reuven climbs on the bed of his father's concubine. What happened on that bed is left to one's imagination. The literal interpretation would seem to be that he slept with her, and others claim that he didn't, that he just moved the beds, he got involved in where his father was sleeping. But either way, it was considered to be an incredible affront. Reuven did this, and when Jacob gives his blessings at the end of his life, he basically tells Reuven that because of his instability, because of this kind of behavior, he's losing the right of being firstborn. So Joseph, according to Kli Yakar, will say to Esav, listen, you've done all kinds of things in terms of instability as well, in terms of sexual sins and so on, and just like Reuven lost his position, so did you. There is, however, a much longer exposition on this idea, which is found in a medrash called the Medrash Tanchuma. And I do want to read it and explain it as much as I can. It says, we have a tradition, it starts off telling us that Esav will fall to a descendant of Rachel. It then continues and says, you know how many comparisons, and I'll read it and translate. It says, look how many things that we can compare. And by the way, the verse that it quotes is interesting, because the verse that it quotes is it identifies Rachel's sons as the youngest of the flock. And I want to stay on that point for a second. If you were to write a book review of a book called Genesis, what would your book review be? What's the book about?
Creation.
Okay, that got you in the first verse, and maybe even the first chapter, and if you really want, you can say the first two chapters. You have another roughly 49 chapters to go. So anytime you're going to, you know, say the book review is based upon the first two chapters, and there's another 49. Are the other 49 chapters all about creation? I don't think so.
About the molding of the Jewish
people? Molding the Jewish people is good. What else? Yeah, that's your homework, to write a book review on Genesis. I'll tell you the major theme of the book. The major theme of the book is that younger brothers are successful while older brothers fail. If anybody's an older brother in here right now, I apologize to you. But that's the theme throughout the book. That is actually the one theme that will take you in episode after episode after episode, where the older brother fails. But by the way, do you know why this is so interesting? Because in the ancient world, the fact that you were born first would give you a stronger position in the family. But the extreme of this is Egypt. Okay, let me just do it, a one-minute timeout to explain something to you, and you'll be able to visualize and understand it exactly. You know, one of the 10 plagues in Egypt was the plague of the firstborn. And to us, it's, you know, it probably makes as much sense as the plague of frogs. What is the plague of the firstborn? Who was Pharaoh in Egypt? Pharaoh was the firstborn of 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 the firstborn, and so on. Do you know how you would visualize such a thing? A pyramid. Which means a pyramid is a physical manifestation of the political leadership of Egypt. And who's Moses? Who's confronting him? Moses is not the firstborn. The son of Amram, who's not the firstborn. The son of somebody who's not the firstborn. The son of somebody who's not the firstborn. And you can keep on going as far back as you want. So when you have this confrontation between Moshe and between Pharaoh, what you have are opposites in terms of the political spectrum. Which means Judaism is saying that you earn your position of leadership, and Egypt is saying an accident of birth will confirm your position of leadership. So over here, Esav as the firstborn, and by the way, not just the firstborn, the powerful firstborn, the powerful physical son, he eventually is going to fall into the hands of the youngest ones. And who's the youngest of Jacob's sons? Rachel's sons, because those are the youngest two. Either Joseph or the youngest one is Benjamin. So that goes back to our tension before of which one of those. And this source would suggest both of them have an ability of defeating Esav. It continues and it says that's the reason that when, what I quoted to you before, that's the reason when Moshe goes to war, who does he choose? He chooses Joshua, who comes from Joseph. It then goes on, and you know what, I'm not going to go through every single one of the points over here, but it goes to point after point after point of how Joseph would be able to argue with Esav, including saying, look, you were brought up in the home of two wonderful people, of Isaac and Rebekah, and look how you turned out. And where was Joseph brought up? Joseph says, I spent a lot of my formative years in the house of Potiphar, where both the husband and the wife were completely immoral. And he uses these kinds of arguments one after the other, which is interesting because the arguments don't seem to be one that they would necessarily really have in front, you know, to one another, but it really deals more with a spiritual construct. Okay. Around 400 years ago, there was a man named Rabbi Yeshaya Horowitz. He wrote a book called the Shlach HaKadosh. Shlach stands for Shnei Luchot HaBrit. In it, he has a section that he starts to talk about Yosef and his brothers and Esav. And he tells us the following very frightening thought. What was the word that was used for when Esav gets destroyed? The word was kash, which we translate as straw. Kash, he says, stands for kin'ah and sin'ah. Kin'ah is jealousy, sin'ah is hatred. Kin'ah is also the numerical value of 156, which means it's the same numerical value as Yosef. Yosef was the victim of his brother's hatred and his brother's jealousy. Now, I want to pause there for a second. Kin of Isina, Kash, is also what Esav possesses. Which means, if Jacob was hated by Esav, that would be very sad, and at the end of history, it gets played out however it gets played out. And we said that specifically Yosef is the one who can have moral superiority to Esav, because he doesn't take revenge against his brothers, despite being treated in the terrible way and being the being victimized by their hatred and jealousy. But the question then that comes up is, what is the implication of the hatred and jealousy which is directed towards Yosef in terms of the Jewish people, in terms of Jewish history? So, we're told Yosef says to his brothers, go back to your father, it's all over. Which means Yosef's heart is clear. But and by the way, one of the saddest parts of the book of Bereshit is that his brothers don't necessarily believe him. And after Jacob is dead, they turn around and they say to Joseph, okay, don't kill us, just make us slaves. We'll be your slaves because of what we did to you. We know that you want to get back. And Joseph cries and says, what are you talking about? I don't want to do anything to you. So now the question is, what happens to this hatred? What happens to this jealousy? So if any of you remember Yom Kippur, on Yom Kippur, the middle of the prayers, it speaks about something known as the Ten Martyrs. And in it, we're told a story, which is based upon, the story there is found in a mystical book called the Book of Hechalot, and it tells us the following. It tells us that one of the Roman leaders is reading through the Torah, and it says that the punishment for kidnapping is punishable by death, and therefore he turns to them and says, what punishment do the brothers ever get for kidnapping Joseph? And he says, they never get anything. He says, okay, I'm going to kill the 10 greatest rabbis of this generation, and that will be punishment for Joseph. This is in the prayers of Yom Kippur, if you remember. It says then that one of the rabbis says the name of God. I'm embellishing it based upon the tradition in the mystical sources as well. Goes up into heaven and questions God, and God says, don't question this at all. This is my will. And it says that these 10 rabbis are ended up being executed. So, first, let's try to understand this on one level. The second temple was destroyed because Jews were guilty of groundless hatred, of sinat chinam, which means we ended up incorporating the hatred and jealousy of Esav. When we did that, then the 10 martyrs come back to be executed, because at that point the brothers of Yosef are back. Which means a behavior that takes place in Genesis comes back again at a later point in history when we act the same way. Which means Joseph, for his part, has moral superiority to Esav because he forgives his brothers for what they did. But that forgiveness, as far as God is concerned, only holds so long as the Jews rejected that type of behavior. When we go back to a behavior motivated by hatred and jealousy, now God's going to come back and demand punishment for what happened a long time ago. Why? Because it's the same. If you want to get into reincarnations and things like that, fine. That's the implication. Now, what the Shlo begins to ask is a very simple question. If there were 10 martyrs, why are there 10? How many brothers are there altogether? There are 12 brothers. Benjamin was with his father. He's not part of the story. So 12 minus 1 is 11. Yosef is a victim, right? So 12 minus 2 now is 10. Reuven, if you read the story, Reuven is the one who says, put him in a pit, and he wanted to bring him back to his father afterwards. So if you take Reuven out of it, you're only left with 9. So the Shlug tells us that he has heard Kabbalists explain that Reuven is nonetheless part of it. Why? Goes back to this week's portion. We're told, and he says that Reuven, the Shlug says something very strange, that Reuven is being punished, not necessarily, he says, well, he doesn't say it that way. Reuven is being punished because of the thing that happened with his father's concubine, by getting on the bed. One of my teachers, Rabbi Soloveitchik, once said something, an insight here, which I thought was absolutely fascinating. What happens? Reuven wants to save Joseph. So what does he do? All the other brothers are plotting to do terrible things to him. He says that he takes him and he puts him in a pit. And then during the whole sale of Joseph, Reuven is gone. Where is he? So Rashi offers two explanations. The first explanation is that it was Reuven's turn to go back and take care of his father. Now, that's very strange. If you want to save somebody, you don't just throw him in a pit. He was going back to his father. He should have taken him back to his father. So rather, Rashi is trying to claim that Reuven, it's his day to take care of his father. So he travels from Dothan, which is around Shechem, all the way back to Hebron, takes care of his father, and comes back again. If you want to save your brother's life, you just now spent at least 3 days, 2 days of traveling and another day of taking care of your father. It doesn't seem to be a very effective way. Therefore, Rashi offers a second interpretation. So it says that Reuven was busy at that moment crying and fasting and praying. You know, and it could be that my wife claims that whenever she needs me, it's always time for me to pray. You know, in the morning the kids got to get up, I have to go pray. In the evening, put them to bed, I have to go pray. And that when the tough gets going, men find religion. But I suspect she says that somewhat facetiously. Why is Reuven praying now? He wants to save his brother's life. Why is he praying? So what my teacher, Rabbi Soloveitchik, suggested is at this moment, Reuven understood something that he never understood before. So I want you to think a second. We spoke about Esav before. Esav said he wants to kill Jacob. When did he say he was going to kill him? When his father is dead. Why? Because Esav had minimal respect, or maybe a lot of respect. I don't want to take that away from him. He had respect for his father. So even if he hates his brother, he's not going to kill his brother while his father's still alive. Why? He doesn't want to cause his father that kind of pain. Over here, the brothers of Joseph are willing to kill him, and their father's still very much alive. So Reuven is looking at this and thinking, how in the world did these people get the audacity to go and do such a terrible thing to their brother? And then it hits him. When Reuven climbs on his father's bed, he's the one who opened the door of disrespect towards their father. You know, sometimes you could do in life, you could do something wrong and not realize the implications of it till a far later point in time. Over here, Reuven realizes that had it not been for his disrespect to his father, the brothers never would have been able to even speak about killing him. So at this point, he prays. If that's the case, then Reuven's sin is related to the sin of the other brothers, because he, in a sense, created the opportunity for that sin. So therefore, I can include Reuven as one of the 10, and therefore the 10 martyrs. Stop. The Shlach Kaddush then says, you know what, there's a second interpretation in terms of the Kabbalists, and that suggests that Reuven is not one of the 10, but Joseph is. And he says, you know what? Joseph also bears responsibility, because Joseph, he told on his brothers and he created the atmosphere that his brothers needed to respond to or felt they needed to respond. And then the Shlach says so far that it's possible that Akiva, Rabbi Akiva, who was one of the 10 martyrs, you know what Rabbi Akiva's full name was? Akiva, the son of Joseph. And he says, Akiva, the son of Joseph, because he may be some kind of a reincarnation of Joseph. Now, I have to stop for a second and fill you in on another piece of information. The great Rabbi Akiva, who we're saying now may have been an incarnation, part of his soul, of the biblical Joseph, is the son of a convert. Not only is the son of a convert, but presumably he comes from the family line of Esav. Have you ever heard of the Tversky family? The Tversky family traces their lineage back to a rabbi who was a rabbi in what would have been a long-forgotten little Russian town. He actually was evicted from the town. And when he was evicted, he said, "This town will pay one day for the way you've treated me." That town, by the way, was called Chernobyl. Yeah. So in a book called Ma'ori Nayim, he tells us the following. Esav was somebody whose hands were full of violence, but his mouth was able to try to convince his father that he was in fact holy. Again, he asks his father, how could he, you know, give a tenth from straw? So he says the secret of Esav being able to fool his father was that Esav, when he asked these questions, was sincere. It wasn't that he was lying. It wasn't that it was totally, you know, mundane. that there was holiness in what he was saying. And by the way, the Arizal, one of the greatest Kabbalists, points out that when you know the story of when Esav dies? We're told in the Medrash, told by the rabbis, that when they came the day of Esav's death, what happened? Jacob had died. And Jacob's family brings back Jacob's remains to the cave of Machpelah to bury him there. Esav comes running and saying that I'm the one who should be buried there and not my brother. So they send one of the brothers running back to Egypt to bring the bill of sale. Meanwhile, that there was somebody named Hushim. I once gave a whole talk about Hushim. Hushim, by the way, is an acronym of Mashiach. Hushim, actually, the word Hush means sense. But it says that he was deaf. Hushim couldn't hear. And Hushim sees this guy stopping the funeral, and he pulls out a sword, and he kills Esav, and he chops his head off. But then the Medrash continues that his head goes rolling, and his head rolls into the Marat HaMachpelah, into the cave of Machpelah, into the arms of Yitzchak, and he holds Esav's head. This whole bizarre thing that Arizal says, because Esav's head, which is based upon his words, that was able to go into the cave of Machpelah, but his hands and the rest of his body couldn't. His rest of his body was full of sins, but the mouth was full of holiness. You with me still? Esav asks about straw. Can I give tzedakah from straw? In the Talmud, there's one story that I'm aware of, which the Maori Naim quotes, of a man performing charity with straw. Who is that man? Rabbi Akiva. We're told that when Rabbi Akiva got married, he was so poor, and his wife came from a very wealthy family, and the father cut them off because she married this convert or the son of a convert who was ignorant and so on, the man who later becomes the great Rabbi Akiva. And it says they were so poor, all they had in their house was straw. And she lamented the fact, look, we have nothing. And Rabbi Akiva said, I'm sure there are people that have less than us. And God then sent Eliyahu Navi, Elijah the prophet, who comes knocking at the door and says, my wife just gave birth and we need some straw. Now, I don't know why you need straw. Then again, I'm not an OBGYN. But he said, we need some straw for her to lie down or something. Do you have any straw that we can borrow? And Rabbi Akiva turns to his wife, or Akiva turns to his wife, and says, look, there are people who have less than we do, and they take the straw and they give some of their straw to this poor man. At that moment, he gave charity with straw. The Maori Naim says, that is what Yitzchak saw when he saw Esav. He saw somebody who's able to perform charity out of straw. Which means what he's telling us is that within Esav there is holiness. And that holiness is manifested by the mouth. And what does Rabbi Akiva become? Rabbi Akiva becomes one of the greatest teachers of Torah Shebaal Peh, of the Oral Torah. When does Rabbi Akiva die? Rabbi Akiva dies by the hands of the Romans, again, quite ironically, as he's saying Kriyat Shema. By the way, the acronym or the Rosh Hetevos of Kriyat Shema is Kash. Kuf Shin, which is straw. So what happens then is that in this wonderful, confused world, Esav is somebody who has hatred towards his brother. And because he has hatred towards his brother, he ends up destroying his entire life. He ends up leaving the family business as it were. He ends up moving further and further. Joseph is the victim of hate, but Joseph doesn't leave. Joseph ends up becoming one of the strongest of the tribes. And Joseph then has the ability to morally answer Esav. Joseph's brothers mistreat him, and in the future we're going to find the 10 tribes, or the 10 martyrs. The 10 martyrs will be killed when the Jews again act like Esav, and who will we be killed by? Who are the 10 martyrs killed by? They're killed by Rome. One of the 10 martyrs is Akiva, the son of Yosef. Akiva is somebody, what is his mantra? What is his favorite teaching? V'haftarecha kamocha. Love your neighbor as yourself. Rabbi Akiva's main thing is a teaching of love and teaching of sharing, teaching of giving, and teaching of altruism. That's Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva is this second coming of Yosef, as it were. Even if he is mistreated, he's still somebody who only teaches that one should do good and so on. Rabbi Akiva, on the other hand, and here's where the irony comes in, is we're told that he's genealogically a descendant of Esav. He's the person who Yitzchak sees, who's able to use the kash, to use the straw, to be able to serve God. He's the one who becomes a master of the oral Torah of the Torah Shebaal Peh. And when he is killed by the Romans, he's killed with a smile on his face, saying the Shema, saying the Kriyat Shema. And at this point, I'm saying all things come back together again. At the end, Esav has the ability of entering back into the Jewish community. Esav has the ability of converting and even becoming a Rebbe Akiva. At the end of days, Esav is going to be obliterated. Obliterated doesn't mean that they have to be annihilated. Obliterated means that the behavior of Esav will have to leave the world. And that will ultimately be the job of Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David. Which means Esav will not be able to exist in a messianic age. And if Esav decides to fight the Messiah, then Esav will be destroyed. If Esav decides to back down and to embrace the teachings, then there is holiness within Esav. Because when it comes down to it, Esav is a son of Rebekah, of Rivka, and Yitzchak. Have a good Shabbos.